you love her?
A normal human being could live under the same roof with her without going nutty. She's my idea of nothing.
I asked you a simple question. Do you love her?
Yes! But don't hold that against me. I'm a little screwy myself.
Welcome to Subtitles, where we spike the canon in music and movies. In each episode, we will offer up replacements for each title in the top 100 of a well-known, well-regarded ranking, and we'll walk away with a pair of subtitles which we think deserve more acclaim and to which attention must be paid. I'm Tim. I'm replacing the entries on the 2007 AFI 100 Years, 100 Movies list, starting with number 100 and working up.
I'm Matt, and I'm replacing the top 100 entries on Spin Magazine's 2015 list of the top 300 albums from 1985 to 2015, starting with number one and working down.
Here's how this works. The two of us have gone through each list, decided on a theme of the original entry, and have come up with a pair of potential replacement titles which share that theme. We'll talk about that original entry. Sometimes we'll regret that we have to get rid of it, and sometimes we'll rejoice in being able to drop it. But this podcast is not just another dissection of an outmoded list. In part one of this episode, Matt had two new albums to talk through, and I made my choice for the Subtitles album list. Now in part two, I have two new movies to discuss, and Matt will decide which of them deserves a place on the Subtitles movie list. Sometimes I'll listen to the albums, sometimes he'll have seen the movies, but at the end of the day, what matters is how well we've sold the titles, and at the end of some of those days, one of us will want to bop the other for that choice. Once we finish these lists off, we'll do some fun activities with these new lists we've collaborated on, but before we can get there, we have to do this. Today's title, to be replaced, is It Happened, One Night, by Frank Capra, 1934, and here's the thing about It Happened, One Night, is that the title is a lie. It does not happen over the course of one night. It happens over the course of a few nights. This entire thing is based on a falsehood, and I think more of us ought to be considering that particular silliness. Matt seems to want to.
No, I do. It depends on what we consider it to be in reference to, which admittedly is a vagueness in the title that is perhaps detrimental to our understanding of the film, but it depends largely on what it references.
I take your point there. Even accounting for that, I'm not all the way sure what it means, which I think is sort of an issue here.
I'm not saying it fixes it. I'm just saying maybe they could have been forgiven, but I think certainly the movie does not happen in one night.
No, it does not. It Happened One Night is a film about a runaway heiress whose father wants her to annul her eloped marriage. So Ellie Andrews is played by Claudette Colbert, and she is seen at first pitching a fit in the stateroom on this yacht, and then dives off the deck and swims away post haste from her father. In the meantime, there is a journalist with a drinking problem named Peter Warren. He's played by Clark Gable. And he happens to end up on the same bus that the spoiled little rich girl has ended up on. It's like the forerunner to every other romantic comedy you've ever seen. And I mean this in the good way and the bad way. So the film, like I said, is from 34. I'm going to count out loud real quick so all of you will learn what numbers I know. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. This is the 8th oldest movie from the AFI list, which, I mean, puts it in a pretty select group as far as that's concerned. It's also one of the only old movies that isn't silent. So out of the truly old movies, it's the third oldest talkie. And this is also a pre-code movie. We'll talk about that. It's not literally the last pre-code movie, but it's pretty darn close. But it is old enough that it is able to set the standard for a lot of your romantic comedy stuff. So we have two people who are not like each other. One of those people is usually on the run from something. The other frequently has some incentive to stop them from running. in this case, Peter realizes who Ellie Andrews is, understands that he could make a killing selling the story about being on the night bus with this woman. And then, of course, after a series of hijinks, shenanigans, and other tomfoolery, the two of them realize they have feelings for each other. And this part of the film, like the first two-thirds, is actually better than I remembered. I saw this once when I was in my mid-20s, because it's one of the canonical movies. And it's a movie which didn't leave a sour taste in my mouth exactly, but I thought the last third of it didn't work so well. And the reason I think that is because no last third of a romantic comedy works well. There's just something, this is going to be maybe the hottest take of the month for me, but just like there's something about the genre in which you put so much emotional energy into breaking them up, there's nothing you can do in the last 10 minutes that will make their reuniting feel as good as the breaking up feels bad. Like, I just don't think that's something that any of these know how to overcome. And It Happened One Night has the same problem, except because it's not literally the first one, but pretty darn close. The part where the two of them separate with a misunderstanding of one another is significantly longer than your average rom-com dust-up, I think. It takes up a bigger chunk of the movie, or at least it feels like it does. And then the part where they reunite, you actually don't even see them. You're relying on some gags and quips from earlier in the movie to know that they're in a little cabin together and they've made up with one another. So it's a better movie than I remembered it being. It is more charming than I remembered it being. And the scenes that work in this movie and which are super, super famous still work and still are successful. I don't know if you've seen this, but I bet you know the favorite trivia fact about it.
I do. That's really the only way I know it. Do you want the pleasure?
No, I hate it. Go ahead.
It's part of Tim's, I don't know, favorite set of movies that won the five major or won the five big awards that it can at the Oscars. So Best Picture, Director, Actor, Actress, and its respective screenplay award. And the first to do so, yes?
Yes. Yes, it is. I mean, it's so inescapable at this point. Like, I opened up the Criterion booklet, because I read through the essay, and Farron Smith Neame, who is one of my favorite movie writers, period, but maybe my favorite writer about classic movies, she even starts with it. I'm like, oh my gosh, like, we can't escape it. Even this incredibly insightful critic is still writing about this. Someone who, I wish I had her insight about classic film. Like, it always starts with this, and that's what it's doing on this list. It's not even about romantic comedies. It's not even about Clark Gable. It's not even about Claudia Colbert. It's not even about Frank Capra. I think this is the lowest Capra on the list. We will get to two more of his, and we'll talk about them later. But, like, the reason it's here is because everybody just wants to talk about the five Oscars it won. And it totally misses the point of what makes this movie interesting. For me, what makes the movie so much fun, again, in the first two-thirds, when people actually want to have fun at romantic comedies, because why would you want the last third to be interesting? But the first two-thirds have a number of pretty good gags. You have the night bus sequences, which are the most Capra-esque of them, I think. It's the one most about the sort of impromptu community of well-meaning and good-hearted people. It's those sequences which take Ellie and turn her from this, again, this sort of poor little rich girl type, and start to show that she does have a heart and she does have some consideration for other people. And she is able to engage in the larger community as it stands. So there's like sing-alongs on the bus. It's done in a really fun way. You get to see this one sailor who like really gets into the man on the flying trapeze. Like that's like his favorite song or something. He's like dancing up and down the aisles. The bus driver who is separated from it, like with the curtain, like even he starts to get into it. There's just like this really strong sense of camaraderie, which is appealing. You have Clark Gable doing Clark Gable charm as opposed to Clark Gable big strong man. And I like Clark Gable big strong man. I think that's an interesting part. But it's sort of fun just to watch him do Clark Gable, who just happens to be this very handsome, very charming, very winning personality. He's funny. He's self-effacing in certain sequences. He's just got like this way of being a lot of fun and very entertaining and just like true star power. Let's look at him. And Claudia Colbert, I think, eventually gets some places to open up the engine and go a little bit. She opens up the throttle, maybe that's the phrase I was looking for, and just gets to ride a little faster. I know that I think she's given more leeway to be witty or cutting or funny in a Lubitsch movie or in a Sturges movie. Like, we talked about how good I thought she was in The Palm Beach Story, for example. But she's still really good in this. Like, it's got some pieces which are genuinely entertaining. The scene that everyone remembers from this is the one where Claudia Colbert sticks her, like, basically naked leg into the road to stop someone so they can hitchhike. And that scene is justly famous. But the reason it's so funny is because Clark Gable has been giving her, like, the encyclopedic run-through of every possible way to put your thumb out so people will pick you up while you're hitchhiking. And he's debuting, like, the solid thumb and the sad thumb and all of this stuff. And then eventually, as this line of cars just totally ignores every thumb he puts out there, he ends up, like, just sticking his thumb on his nose and, like, wiggling his fingers at the last car because he's just like, whatever, man. And that's the scene where he starts it off by eating carrots like Bugs Bunny, or I should say, Bugs Bunny eats carrots like Clark Gable, because to the best of my knowledge, they steal that particular little, carrot tops and all. Like, they steal that image from Gable in this movie. I mean, it's a lot of fun watching them do stuff. It's a lot of fun watching Clark Gable convince this one guy that he's in the mob and he's gonna, like, kill his family and then sends him off into the woods never to be seen again. I realize that sounds dark, but it really is entertaining in the moment. The scene that I think made the biggest impression on people in 1934 is the source of our theme. But I didn't know if there was anything else about this movie that you wanted to ask or opine or anything like that.
Being chased by the mob, romance, comedy, finest examples. What happens in all our favorite Hugh Grant movies now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like the thing about this movie, it's not bad. Like, I think it's a good movie. I do believe in this movie's goodness. I do believe in its quality. I do believe even in, like, the influence and all of that. Just, I don't know. If you fast forward even a little bit, you can find better, richer, more compelling, more artful romantic comedies from other Hollywood directors, and they just work better than this one does all the way through. I just really feel like this is in here because of the Oscars.
Yeah, sure, whatever. But do any of them have categorizations as fun as the various types of hitchhiking thumbs? Because I'm totally in on that.
I mean, the hitchhiking thumb stuff is pretty good. Like, that really is a very good scene. And Gable, sells it, you know? Like, I think it's very easy to think about Clark Gable as Rhett Butler or Clark Gable as Fletcher Christian. Like, people are always going to imagine Gable as the King of Hollywood type. But, like, in the first half of the 30s, there are a lot more let's do Gable with a little bit of pep in his step, a little bit of sardonic wit. And he really is, this really is a good performance from him. I think Colbert is sort of underused here because there's more than what she gets to show. But when Gable is given an opportunity to like run a scene or even set up the first 90% of a joke and let someone else take the punchline, as in this one, like it works. Like it really is fun to like watch this very self-assured man. And I realize this must sound ridiculous if you've never seen it, but the way he like cocks his thumb is funny. Like that's a gift of physical humor that only so many people have. I mean, the movies that are around the same age as this on the list that are talkies are both Marx Brothers movies. Like, I'm not saying that I need to see Clark Gable doing a physical comedy bit with Harpo, but I'm saying he would be able to hold up. He would be able to hang in there just fine, even if that's like a completely impossible thing to imagine.
I think Colbert sticking her leg out is the it of the title. I put it to you.
Happens in the afternoon. The scene that maybe the it does happen for, so maybe this is it. The film, I think in its time, was maybe most famous for a scene in which Gable goes totally shirtless. He is explaining to Peter's sort of doing a bit with Ellie because they have to. The bus gets stuck in a sort of flooded area. Everybody has to get off and go to camp in some, you know, little grounds. So Peter manages to convince the proprietors that he and Ellie are married because they would have to be in 1934. And they are sharing a room, but for the sake of modesty, they put a blanket up in the middle of the room, which is nicknamed the Walls of Jericho, but Peter's on the other side of the Walls of Jericho as he demonstrates how he undresses for Ellie's benefit and presumably for the benefit of everyone. We're just going to say everyone. For the benefit of everyone who went to see this picture. And of course, there's this story that undershirt sales plummeted after the movie, but this is not really true. If they did plummet, it didn't have anything to do with Clark Gable, but you could understand if they did. It's a scene where you do get to have all that pre-code glory of a man taking his clothes off and doing a lot of banter as he does it. It's clear that this is a big moment. And so that brings us to our theme for this episode, which is beefcake. And beefcake is an extremely funny word. Perhaps it's what hamburger should actually be called, but it's a term which has a long and glorious history in the cinema. If you look into other parts of the internet, you may find things that you don't want to Google from your work computer, so I advise you to be careful. But in the history of Hollywood, there is this sort of lineage of types of lovers and types of male romantic figures that stand out. And this is not the first example of beefcake, but it is sort of an earlier example because Gable was tall and Gable was muscular. But we can talk lineage a little bit if you would like, and then move into our actual two movies here.
I would love lineage because I'm having another moment, and I'm pretty sure we talked about this in a past episode. But like, I'm looking at the images of Gable, and man, Beefcake was just more like it looked more attainable mm-hmm. back then. Like, I could do that maybe instead of. Oh God, what is happening with that man's body?
Yeah, so I think the thing that's interesting is that in the silent era, the preeminent type of romantic figure is the quote-unquote Latin lover. Someone who is supposedly has some kind of Mediterranean features. A lot of movies about women going to exotic places and meeting exotic men, and having exotic dalliances. So, for example, this is Rudolph Valentino's Lane, The Sheik, Blood and Sand, to some extent even something like Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, and then from Valentino on, you get a run of people who do sort of exemplify this kind of person. Some people get stuck there, like Ramon Navarro, who we've talked about in The Desol already. And some people are, like Frederick March is weirdly enough an example of this, and he turns into a prestige actor. But this sort of like Latin lover who is very amorous and very seductive and very physically lithe, typically. Not usually a big, strong dude, usually someone who's more like pretty. Like there's a prettiness which is emphasized. So even if you're like Gary Cooper, for example, who is not strictly a Latin lover type, you still see a lot of his earlier roles being subsumed into this particular area. And then somewhere... Well, go ahead.
Well, he is super duper.
Yeah, I'm good. I listen to that song more than I should, and I don't watch the music video because it's haunting and bad. But that's a good Gary Cooper segue. Then you have your, in the 30s, you get some more, exoticism, but that's like your Johnny Weissmullers, playing Tarzan, and you get to see him running around without his clothes on, basically. And then of course that gets stopped up. And then in the 30s, like the mid-late 30s after the Hays Code comes in, then you start to get more clothed heroes who are dapper and debonair and witty. So this is William Powell. This is Fred Astaire. You can sort of see the connecting points with Gable or John Barrymore or something like that. And then the 40s we can kind of skip. But in the 50s, kind of with the advent of color, This is the true golden age of beefcake, the true golden age of muscular, manly men, doing muscular, manly things. Yes, it's homoerotic. That's kind of the point. So you've got Kirk Douglas, you've got Rock Hudson, you've got Alan Ladd to some extent. Tab Hunter gets to go in this category. Even people like Tony Curtis kind of get thrown in here, and we're going to talk Tony Curtis later. But, like, he's got a good body, he worked out, and you can put him in something skimpy. Burt Lancaster. I almost picked The Crimson Pirate for this, but, like, because that's a movie where he barely wears a shirt and mostly just wears striped pants. It's like the full MacArthur Park, but it's so campy, I can't even accept it. Like Beefcake has some aspect of seriousness about it because otherwise you just giggle. And that's basically what The Crimson Pirate is. And then by the time you get into the 80s, you've got like Arnold Schwarzenegger. And we're going not just like, here are some guys who are naturally kind of bigger and who are lifting, but guys who are lifting. And then of course the 80s has like the giant European men. And since then we've sort of come around, like it sort of goes in and out of vogue. But the beefcake thing is not begun strictly with Clark Gable, who is again, not like huge in this, like he's not enormous, but there is an obvious attempt to make his, you know, his bare chest and his, you know, his, his shirtless body talking about undressing. Like, it's meant to have this physical appeal, and there is an obvious physical appeal in getting Clark Gable to take his shirt off, because he's pretty, I don't know that bare-chested is the right word, but he, like, doesn't exactly wear a tie for Mutiny in the Bounty, or on the Bounty the next year. And then even in a movie we've talked about, like Mogambo, there's that big scene where he takes his shirt off and the natives throw spears at him. But he's, like, big and muscular. So, like, these things come around. You see the intimations of it here in 1934. And we are going to be talking about two classic beefcakeries in Kirk Douglas in The Vikings from 1958. You can imagine where this is going. And in 1968, Burt Lancaster stars in The Swimmer. Anything about this very straight-laced, not super erotic description of beefcake that we need to review real fast?
No, I like the special delivery of beefcake. So I think we should keep that going the whole time. I guess surprised there's no Rock Hudson here. You did mention him, though, so I guess we'll take that and move forward.
Yeah, I mean, I thought about it. The thing about Hudson is that in most of the roles I kind of was looking for, I was looking for something with a lot of shirtlessness, and the Hudson roles in the movies that are, like, most memorable, like, we've already done All That Heaven Allows, and those other ones, like, there's some of that in Magnificent Obsession, but there's a different aspect going on where his hunkiness is part of the character in a way that advances the melodrama of the story. And in these two movies, the hunkiness is kind of there for its own sake, but also being complicated or problematized in a way that I find attractive. Not physically attractive, because the things that happen are actually kind of sad, but, like, attractive in an intellectual way. So It Happened One Night is a very straightforward version of this. The Vikings, how did I put this? It's like chopped up beefcake. that's what The Vikings is about. This is a...
So it's ground beefcake?
Not all the way. I do sort of visualize it on a griddle, though, with, like, the, like, sort of chopping it up in that way. So, yes, I suppose it might start as ground beefcake, chipped beefcake, potentially, depending on your favorite kind of toast. So that's The Vikings. It's a Richard Fleischer movie. Kirk Douglas and Richard Fleischer had teamed up for 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, which is a personal favorite around here. And I mean, that would have qualified if we hadn't used it already, because that's a movie where Kirk Douglas is going around in a striped shirt that is made for someone my size, or maybe like my cat's size, and not for someone Kirk Douglas's size. He really feels that, and there's lots of, like, wet Kirk Douglas and like swimming Kirk Douglas and shirtless Kirk Douglas. Like, that's the model. But The Vikings is this, I mean, what a weird movie this is. I just want to start by talking about how bizarre it is, because it definitely gives this sort of ground beefcake, mutilated beefcake its beginning. So it starts with Orson Welles doing narration about, I know, I love that he's just narrating, like, Orson.
That's not a beefcake.
He's just narrating the horrible things that, like, the Vikings would do when they were pillaging England and stuff. And it's got this fake tapestry thing going on in the opening credits, and it doesn't get any more normal, because the first shot of the movie is Ernest Borgnine, with this big beard going like, "Rah!" and like looking into a tent with the king and queen of England, and like he kills the king of England, and then it becomes very clear that he rapes the queen. And not only that, that child grows up to be Tony Curtis, who is the half-brother to Ragnar. This is Ernest Borgnine plays Ragnar, which I think we just kind of have to talk about. We will mention it here and come back. But Einar is Ragnar's legitimate son, or at least legitimate-er son. This is Kirk Douglas and Tony Curtis grows up to be Eric. But I just want to start with this idea of this is a film in which the two protagonists of the story are half-brothers, but are half-brothers by rape. And one of them grows up groomed to be the next king of the Vikings, Kirk Douglas does, and the other one grows up without an identity, and is a slave among the Vikings. And it's a very, very dark way for this to begin. There's a sequence where this one English lord gets kicked out of England by the new, not by the new king, but by the king who had succeeded, the one who's killed in the first sequence. And this king kicks out Lord Egbert, played by James Donald, who is one of those classic British actors who looks exactly like you think James Donald looks. And, like, there's this big thing like, oh no, I'm not a traitor, you're a tyrant, yada, yada, yada. And then it turns out that he is a traitor, and he has been selling out the other English to the Vikings in return for not having his coast raided so much. And, like, it's a film where so often you have this, like, oh, I know where this is going. It's a Technicolor epic from the 50s, and, like, I sort of get it. But it actively tramples on all of that in the first 10 minutes. It's a very weird thing. And what's also weird about it is that Einar is just a real piece of work. Like, this is the Viking in the most frightening literal sense, I guess. Like, you think he's gonna be fun. Like, I really went into this movie believing he would be fun. And it starts with Kirk Douglas being buried under this incredible, like, mane of woman's blonde hair because he is cuckolding some other Viking. And, like, I'm like, okay, it's gonna be this kind of movie, and I'll tell you what, Ernest Borgnine never got the memo that he's not in this kind of movie, because my man is just, like, guffawing and drinking and jumping around like a maniac the whole time. But Kirk Douglas starts this off, and I'm like, okay, this is going to be, like, beefcake Kirk Douglas wooing women, you know. And then the further we get into the film, the more clear it is that Einar is just really a nasty guy who uses his beefcake and strength to completely subordinate and tyrannize and terrify basically innocent people. So there is a scene where this woman who he was, you know, sleeping with comes out and, like, has to do a test of faithfulness, which is you take her hair, put it into three braids, and then you give her husband some axes. And if he can chop off her braids, then she was faithful. And if anything else happens, like splitting her skull, she wasn't. And Kirk Douglas eventually saves this woman's life from her very bad axe-throwing husband. But she also is the woman with these, like, little sad braids who then just continues to serve boozles to the Vikings the whole time. Like, it's... And I don't... Like, part of that, I think, is meant to be funny, and part of it, I think, is also meant to be sort of like, eee. Like, here's a guy who creates ugly situations for other people and has been able to get out of the consequences through his physical strength or through his warrior prowess or something like that, by having the broadest shoulders and the biggest muscles. And this is just a very interesting way to go about it, where, like, does might make right? And the film leads you to believe all the way through that you're going to be on Einar's side, but it's just sort of impossible to be until eventually you're not. I realize I'm doing a lot of intro, but I don't think The Vikings is a super widely seen movie.
No, I think the Vikings are a super widely adapted thing, but this particular movie, I don't think, is near the top of anyone's known Viking adaptation things. Though Ragnar is certainly one of the, like, bigger myths among, mm-hmm. well, the historical myths among them. So But yeah, I didn't know about this one at all, though. The Ernest Borgnine of it. I'm so interested.
So it's currently on Amazon. It was on Criterion for a minute, and I'm like, I don't think I'm that interested in this movie, and then it left Criterion, and then I changed the theme for this, and I'm like, why didn't I watch Kirk Douglas and the Vikings? So luckily for me, it was on Amazon, and I was able to catch it. The film does not leave Kirk Douglas whole for very long, and if we want to talk about the ground beefcake of all of this, there's a sequence pretty early where Kirk Douglas has, like, a falcon attached to his wrist, like the Vikings doing falconry, and he's, like, bragging about the quality of Viking falconry with Lord Egbert, who has by now taken refuge with the Vikings. And his falcon doesn't seem very good at this, but there's another falcon belonging to Tony Curtis wearing a leather outfit where I swear you can see his butt. He is barely wearing anything to cover up his Johnson, whether or not it honks. And, like, it's a very revealing outfit, and the two of them have this confrontation, and it ends with Tony Curtis throwing his falcon at Kirk Douglas's face, and then the falcon, like, tears up his face and scars him and, like, gets his eye and everything. So within the first, like, 5 to 10 minutes of Kirk Douglas, he's been mutilated. Like, it starts off really fast with him having his eye taken out by this bird, who was, like, gouging at him and doing all this other stuff. So we immediately have the, like, oh, this is going to be Kirk Douglas the Viking going rawr, and it still is, but it's also Kirk Douglas the Viking going rawr, also I am one-eyed and you know, cut up pretty bad. Does it stop him from jumping from oar to oar in triumph as he returns a kidnapped Welsh princess to Viking land? No. But, like, he still does a lot of the other stuff you're used to, but he is not pretty in this. Like, they take away a lot of the attraction that you might have, unless, of course, you are a Viking woman who prefers scars on the men, which is, I understand it, is big. I don't know. I'm not going to guess what women back then liked. And then, on the other hand, Tony Curtis, finds his, like, we don't have to talk about the whole way he gets there, but he winds up in Northumbria, and he refuses to just push Ragnar into a pit of wolves, which, like, maybe we can talk about this, because Ragnar has been captured by the English. You know, he's been brought back by Eric, and he's brought Morgana, who is the Janet Leigh character. Very weird to watch Tony Curtis and Janet Leigh in something, by the way. And he's got Ragnar and turned him over to the king, and the king is like, we're gonna throw Ragnar into the pit of wolves so he can be eaten alive. And, like, eventually Ragnar gets Eric to give him a sword, basically. It's like, let me die with a sword in my hand. And then after Eric cuts his bonds and, like, gives him the sword, Ragnar goes full Geronimo into the pit of wolves. And, like, I shouldn't laugh because he dies. But, like, in the pit of wolves, like, you see, the shot comes from underneath Ernest Borgnine as he jumps into the pit, and then the camera just sort of, like, slowly turns around at all the English lords who are looking at this and going, like, yeah. Like, it's Ernest Borgnine is in, like, a serio comedy about a heroic Viking nutcase, and everyone else is in Richard Fleischer's Titus Andronicus, because right after this, the King of England takes the sword and chops off Tony Curtis's hand for disobeying him. and then they cauterize it instantly with a torch that someone's just holding. So for the rest of the movie, you've got Kirk Douglas, where, like, again, huge, but, like, also mutilated in the face, and you have Tony Curtis with his butt hanging out, like, with this big sock on his hand, because he doesn't have a hand anymore. And the sword fighting and the conflict that goes between the two of them, where the climax of the film is, like, it is between these two extremely ground-up pieces of beefcake. And it's something which is kind of, you know, you could watch another one of these ancient epics, like even Ben-Hur, you know, like we talk about Ben-Hur, but like Charlton Heston, great example, Stephen Boyd, great example, two men, very handsome, in great shape, etc. But like, those two at least get to be whole and hale for everything until the Boyd character dies. But like, the Vikings is taking this concept of you're going to watch these hot people in the movie in these skimpy period costumes go at it, and it takes away a lot of the presumed pleasure of doing that, which I find very interesting. Like, it's been 25 years-ish, not literally, but close, since Clark Gable took his shirt off, and now we're seeing how the movies are taking this idea of let's, you know, give you this very tight leather vest or something, and we're not going to make it fun and you know, sexy. We're going to make this into, this is the uniform of people who are being chopped up by the terrible circumstances of the times they live in. It's a very sobering movie in a lot of ways. It's like an action movie, and it's obviously meant to be fun, but like, once Ernest Borgnine dies, this thing get real dark.
Well, it's interesting that it kills off the, I mean, it's not like Borgnine is performing the actions of a typical beefcake, it would sound like, or it does sound like, rather, like, once he's gone, you lose that element of it, so the beefcakery of it all has to take a different tenor. Like, you lost the crazy guy who's gonna go Rambo on all the wolves' asses. Like, there's nothing positive to do or heroic to do with the beefcakery from there.
And what's so interesting about that is that, like, 3 years earlier, Ernest Borgnine made his name as, in a Best Picture winner, as the guy who was too ugly to have a girlfriend or a wife. Like, in his bit parts before Marty, and then in Marty itself, like, the point of the guy is that he's shaped like a gorilla and almost as ugly. And, like, he actually kind of looks better with a beard that hides his face because his face is ugly. And, like, there's, like, the guy who you would think is going to get to swashbuckle a little bit. I mean, we didn't talk about Errol Flynn at all, but, like, the Errol Flynn of Captain Blood or the Seahawk or something, where, like, the appeal is in shirtless whipping, or the Errol Flynn of Adventures of Robin Hood, where the appeal is in the tights, you know, like, he's the only guy who's doing a role like that, and he is, again, nobody's idea of a good time. Just, I mean, he's a good time in terms of watching, but in terms of looking, that's a very different matter. So yeah, this, again, it's a really weird, like, tonally, it's so strange, and, like, usually I think that's a problem, but in this case, I think that's kind of the point of the movie, is how tonally strange it is.
Yeah, I find that very fascinating, like, in general, and not to make this totally the Borgnine appreciation hour, but yeah. I also find it endlessly amusing that I think he is not, this is another great, wait a minute instance. I think most people our age in particular would know him as the voice of Mermaid Man on SpongeBob.
Take down all those new pictures of Ernest Borgnine you've got hanging in your den. 1968's The Swimmers, directed by Frank Perry. It is a totally different movie from The Vikings. This one is based, if I am not mistaken, on a John Cheever short story. So, if, yes, this one's based on on a Cheever short story. So if you were looking for something that was the opposite of Vikings, may I give you mid 20th century ennui in Connecticut?
I don't know, man. I could make a SpongeBob reference with the first and a Seinfeld one with the second. So
it's a very different type of film. The Swimmer is about Burt Lancaster's character, named Ned Merrill, and Ned is, I mean, he's who you expect basically from this particular type of wealthy Connecticut businessman, essentially. Lancaster is, I mean, here's a guy who, in the 50s and early 60s. I find really interesting because he was constantly trying to find ways to sort of downplay how hot he was. There's a picture which was going around on Twitter like a couple years ago of Gene Kelly, Burt Lancaster, and John Garfield at like a celebrity baseball charity game or something. And Burt Lancaster is like the hottest Brooklyn dude in the world. Like, he's wearing these glasses, but like he's so built, and you're just like, this is hilarious. This is like the goofiest, sexiest man in the world. And then he plays these guys in a lot of movies who are older or weirder than he actually was. So like you go through the 50s and you watch like Come Back Little Sheba, where he's supposed to be playing this middle-aged alcoholic, or the Rose Tattoo, where he's doing like a Mario and Luigi style Italian accent, or Judgment at Nuremberg, where he's playing this like late middle aged Nazi jurist at the Nuremberg trials. Like all of these people are kind of working against this model of, let's see, sexy Burt Lancaster without his shirt. And in this movie, like, this is a 90 minute movie basically, and he's basically in a Speedo the whole time. So like, it's just Burt Lancaster in his mid-50s, I'm gonna add, Burt Lancaster, who is in terrific shape, just truly great shape for a guy this age. He makes me feel very bad about myself. But he's this very good looking guy, like middle age, but he is really just in a bathing suit this entire movie. We are getting an opportunity to see some beefcake. But like, the idea about The Swimmer is that it's expired beefcake. Like, that's kind of what this is about, is that the beefcake here is past the sell by date. Ned Merrill shows up at a neighbor's house one morning. These people had been partying the night before, and they are like sitting by their pool and drinking some, like, you know, some drinks to like take the edge off their hangovers, basically. They're doing some hair of the dog stuff, and he like kind of shows up out of the woods. He just sort of appears, and they're like, "Ned, what are you doing here? Where are your clothes?" And he's like, "Well, I have this idea." You know, he's just out and about that morning in his Speedo, and as he talks to these people, he realizes that he can quote-unquote swim home. All he has to do is swim a lap through these pools to get back to his house, and he gets really excited about this idea of swimming through this river of swimming pools from this neighbor's house to his actual home. And that's like the backbone of this story. These people he interacts with along the way, some of whom he knows, a lot of them he doesn't, or hasn't had a lot of contact with recently. And you basically are watching him in these different scenarios where he wants to, quote unquote, swim his way home. And I don't know. What do you think is the matter with him? I assume this is not one you've seen either. It's definitely turned into a cult favorite, I will say that.
No, I've not seen. I don't know. It seems like a weird midlife crisis happening. There could be a lot of symbolism in Swim His Way Home, and I don't really want to invoke Freud, but I think Freud's right there.
Yeah, I mean, this is a guy who's straight up having a nervous breakdown in front of his neighbors, friends, and vague acquaintances. I mean, honestly, the first half of the movie is almost cheerful. You know, like, and it's sort of a, like, a darkly cheerful way, but, like, there's some, like, genuine decent vibes going on. There's this, like, hot chick who used to babysit his kids, and now she's, like, 20 or something, and it's, like, she's always had a crush on Mr. Merrill, and he basically gets her to come with him for a while to swim his way home, and they're both in their bathing suits, and they're jumping over hurdles in slow motion together. And they're swimming through pools together and, like, having a grand old time. And then he gets a little weird about her. Like, weird in a I-can-take-care-of-you kind of way. Like, you get the sense she'd be up for, like, let's get weird in a I-could-be-your-dad and let's, you know, let's bone in one of these pools or something. Like, you can imagine, like, something like that that she'd be up for. But when he starts getting, like, a little too tender with her, it, like, freaks her out a little bit because it feels weird. Like, that's where, like, the nervous breakdown of it all, like, really starts to show itself. Like, this is not just a kooky guy who's like, good morning, neighbors. Here I am. Like, this, like, he's not, like, neighborhood kook. He's, like, neighborhood, like, freak a little bit. And here he is in his bathing suit talking about, like, taking care of her, and it just sort of, like, it feels so strange. And you sort of expect that to be the turning point for the film in which everything else goes downhill, but it's not quite. Because you can, you know, just like you can sniff that slightly expired beefcake and you sort of try to get a sense of is it still good and the first whiff might be okay, there is a sequence where he's, like, in this empty swimming pool. And there's this kid in the empty swimming pool, and he decides, you know what, if I hang out with this kid, we both, like, do the stroke in this empty swimming pool, it counts as swimming. And he, like, has this, like, really sweet moment with the kid. Like, it really is, like, this unfeigned moment of generosity. And then late, like, a couple minutes later after they do that, the kid is, like, bouncing on the diving board, and Burt Lancaster, like, pulls him off, because if he falls, he's gonna, like, break something. And there's this, again, like, you can see that there is a person in there with a mind, and you can see there's a person in there with some, like, some moral fiber, but the further he goes on his swimming home trip, the more it becomes clear that there's some malfeasance or there's some scandal that's following him. He is not all the way in control of his ability to, like, react to stuff. So there's this, like, white hot dog cart at a neighbor's party, and he's making a big deal about, where did you get this? This was mine. And, like, the guy bought it fair and square, but, like, he has no memory of it. He visits the woman he used to be, like, cheating on his wife with and is, like, swimming across her pool. And that's sort of an awkward, like, an awkward, discussion. And then eventually he gets to a public pool and he gets this real dressing down from the kid in front, who's like, your feet are filthy. You need to shower first. You need to sanitize yourself. You can't come in here. And then when he actually is in the pool, like, people are making fun of him and yelling at him because apparently all of the bad stuff that's happened is, like, common knowledge, down to, like, possibly bankruptcy, not being able to pay bills, stuff like that. It is a movie which is, again, I've used this word a few times for the Vikings, but, like, there's this sobering aspect about it. It's a movie which does have a lot of really, like, ugly, awkward situations, and it's not necessarily a fun movie to watch. Lancaster's giving one of his great performances, and I am a huge Burt Lancaster stan, as we have discussed a few times on this podcast already, and, like, this is one of his best performances, just flat out. This is a really interesting combination of his confidence and his his charm and his star power and his charisma up against this thing that you can only really get out of the really hot actors. Like, this is like the Leo DiCaprio world where you can make fun of how you are because you're hot enough to live through it. Like, this is where George Clooney and Leonardo DiCaprio like to go. And Burt Lancaster just lives there more easily and more powerfully than either one of them do. And you're watching Lancaster do these really athletic things, and you get the sense of, like, yes, this is the guy who could have been like a Victor Matcher or Tyrone Power matinee idol type. But who ended up going for these, like, weird, serious roles, willing to play the heavy, willing to play, like, the difficult, nasty person. And in this case, Ned is not a nasty person, but he's so confused that there's just such a disconnect between what's going on upstairs and what is, you know, what appears to be fine on the outside. I mean, he looks good. He's in great shape. He swims just fine. Like, all of that. It's just, he is clearly not all there upstairs. And that is a great dramatic performance from him. Thoughts about the swimmer?
Not really. It is a conceit that I was not sure at all how it was going to work, but I think it does now. So, I mean, I don't know if I credit Cheever the movie with that, but, like, that's just kind of fun on its own. And I'm sure Lancaster is making the character work, but yeah, I was just really interested how that whole conceit was going to follow through. And it seems like it does, which is impressive on its own, right? But not like, I like what it's doing with beefcakiness, but that's not necessarily speaking to the beefcake itself.
Yeah, the director of this is Frank Perry, who did a number of movies, like, in this haute bourgeois world. Like, I think the next one, I forget if this is literally the next one, but if it's not, it's close, is Diary of a Mad Housewife, which has Carrie Snodgrass, Richard Benjamin, and a very young Frank Langella, all doing, like, this episodic satire of one of these, like, really educated women who then has to be turned into this housewife for this moron that she met in college at her very sophisticated university. And, like, that same milieu is, like, what Perry's doing with the swimmer and with Lancaster. And I really like Diary of a Mad Housewife. Like, on the whole, I think it works better than the swimmer does, but, like, there is something really potent in how focused the swimmer is, as well as how like, weird it is. Like, it is such a weird concept, and it has just the right amount of, like, old Hollywood machismo star power, because it is just Burt Lancaster in his black Speedo just showing up. And, like, there is something about that which does feel like it should be on a poster somewhere outside of a multiplex. Like, that image, like, just works on that very obvious, very basic sexual level. And then to see how that is the last vestige of what's actually working in this man's life, like, the only thing that is still functioning for this otherwise really, like, someone who really needs some help, like, doesn't need rejection, doesn't need to be swimming home, but someone who, like, needs help. That's a very interesting portrayal, and, like, a really interesting way to, like, work around an image which Lancaster 15 years earlier was doing as well as anybody else. Anything else on the swimmer or the Vikings or It Happened One Night?
How about something else on Frank Perry?
Okay.
Decidedly not beefcake.
No.
B, also did Mommy Dearest, so I feel like you buried the lead slightly there.
which is incidentally, like, I've another kind of, I guess, like a send-up of, like, an old Hollywood icon, right? Like, in a much more literal way. And, like, Mommy Dearest is one of my... This should have been so much weirder movies. Like, if that movie were, like, as weird as Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, we really would be talking about a classic. But it just isn't. It's a little far away from Perry. Like, he's a director where I feel like when he's on the nose about something, he either absolutely obliterates it, knocks it out of the park, which is what Diary of a Mad Housewife is. And when he's, like, off by a little bit, he, like, absolutely gets his thumb instead of the nail, and that's what Mommy Dearest is. But The Swimmer is just a weirder version of either one, and I do think that's probably a little bit of the John Cheever in it as well. Like, there is this... The film makes you think about Cheever as a writer, as a short story writer. Like, you can see him in it, even though the story has been expanded significantly from the original that he wrote. All right. So our two films today are in service of the idea of Beefcake, which we see in a very early form, a not entirely domesticated or built-up form, but that belonging to Clark Gable in It Happened One Night, which is the AFI list representative here at number, oh golly, is it 46? I was going to feel really good about being able to say which number it was, and then it just all went away from me so fast. I'm gonna go with it. So that's the original AFI one. It won't be the first time I've been wrong about the number doing this. Frank Capra's romantic comedy to sort of begin and end all romantic comedies with Clark Gable and Claudia Colbert. And we are thinking about the idea of Beefcake and how that particular type of male star and projection of the male body and projection of what kind of movie stars we want our muscly men to be is reflected, and how that's done in ways that are not just, you know, for ogling or scopophilic purposes. So in a film like Richard Fleischer's The Vikings, the Beefcake is there to be mutilated. It's there to be chopped up. It's there to be put into little patties and thrown to the wolves, as in the case of Ernest Borgnine, doing everything but taking his parachute to fight wolves in a pit. But it's a film which takes some pleasure in showing us Kirk Douglas and Tony Curtis in their, you know, very revealing Viking outfits, where you can see just how big and strong they are, and then slowly but surely mutilating them, giving them amputations, removing their body parts, and showing the brutality of the sort of Beefcake ideal. And then, on the other hand, we have The Swimmer by Frank Perry from 1968, in which Burt Lancaster is sort of like a swimsuit model, is like in a very literal sense, has this swimsuit model thing going on, down to being not all that bright in that stereotype, and projecting himself as this handsome, you know, fit guy. Someone who you would want to, like, look at and stare at, but he is an expired Beefcake. He's a little old, and what's upstairs is, not mooing, is only chewing cud in a way that is not exactly incisive. And so we see this person whose mental life has declined, even as his physical form has held up, and that's the basic concept there. So, we go in with the fighting Ragnars, or the hello, I came out of the woods, let me swim in your pool?
I love both so much. when you put it those ways, we're going to go with the hello, I came out of the woods. And as sad as I am to not see Borgnine through, there's something extra appealing to me here about the what happens behind the Beefcake, as it were.
How do they make the sausage?
How do they make the beef gang? it was right there and I missed it. So not only like the exploration of it, but I find that interesting on its own, but also the, I don't know, it's not enough. Like, maybe it is for a minute, because it seems like this guy had a relatively well-off life and kind of a happy home, and then that all went belly up. And you can still have your literal beefcakery after that, but it's not, right? It is just facade. So I like that working with it, even though we've seen in Hollywood to not, we've not taken that lesson at all, that beefcakery reigns supreme and is, right, a symbol of goodness and heroicness. But I like the Vikings certainly playing with that, and I like that. But I don't know, I like the kind of what you were saying near the end there of, like, it's just not all turning upstairs, and you can have the beefcakery, but like it's not sufficient. Or maybe it is for a limited time, but like, not just what happens if you lose it, but what happens when the moment passes.
And I think that is something which Hollywood movies at least recognize. You know, you can have himbos, and I think about like Chris Hemsworth's supporting turn in the Lady Ghostbusters, where he is very, very funny. And like, the joke is that, but like, you can't make a movie about that. Like, Hollywood beefcake icons have been interesting because they have this sort of emotional vulnerability, or at least the appearance of it, which is like a Rock Hudson thing, or they have, you know, a real acuity to them. Like, Kirk Douglas doesn't play stupid people all that often. He doesn't necessarily play good people, but he plays people with a plan. And like, taking Burt Lancaster and sort of negating that image in a way that Lancaster already loved to negate his own, like, hunky image, is just a super interesting way to go. I don't know where The Swimmer is streaming right now. It's sort of been bouncing between services, so if that is a movie that you're interested in, it is worth the time. It's pretty short, and it's weird. Like, I definitely undersold how weird it was. Like, it is a strange experience to watch that. It's sort of uncanny because you just know you're not getting everything. You can just sort of feel it emanating through the screen, how little you understand of what's going on in that guy's head. So between The Vikings and The Swimmer, Matt has picked The Swimmer to take on It Happened One Night's Place.
I have a parting question.
Yeah.
Who is our current preeminent beefcake?
It might be your estimation. It might be Hemsworth. Like, I think he is the one who is most associated with it. Either him or Hardy. And I think it's appropriate because Hemsworth has been fairly open. He and Hugh Jackman. Jackman's another option. But the two of them have both been super, super open about how being that muscular is fake. Like, it's about dehydrating yourself so that you have like nothing on you, and it's about CGI to like work it up. I would say one of those two. If you want to put Ryan Reynolds in that conversation, you can, but even he is sort of making fun of it because the Deadpool thing is supposed to be making fun of everything anyway. So like, We are not immune to our big manly men. We still like those. We still want to see them on screen, but we also, I think at this point, can't ignore how we got there and how Hugh Jackman looks very different in Wolverine movies than Clark Gable did, just taking his shirt off in It Happened One Night.
And it's totally just the facial hair, nothing else.
Has nothing to do with the very large fingernails that that Clark Gable possesses in that. So, if you enjoyed what we did here, you might like part one of this episode where we talked about the opposite of beefcake, which is probably gauze, in that it is very thin and very not edible. And we talked about that sort of gauzy feeling in the Jesus and Mary Chain Psycho Candy, which is perhaps what Burt Lancaster is taken in The Swimmer. If you like that, you can listen to it as well as other back episodes. You can find the About Me section, you can find an updated and prettier version of the list than we used to have. This is breaking news, which people will hear months later. You can find links to my Letterboxd, his Green Devil. All of that is available at subtitlespodcast.com, and we will see you next time.